This podcast is brought to you by West Virginia locals, drinking moonshine and breaking and entering since the early 1400s.
Menace to society.
It is Shark Week. Everyone watched Shark Week yet?
Yeah, it started it last night.
Heck yeah.
Rob Riggle.
Yeah, that was a little weird.
Yeah, it wasn't very sharky. It was just kind of a comedy bit.
Yeah, it was, I was not a huge fan of that, but love Shark Week. It is Monday, July 29th, 2019 for Patreon subscribers. If you're not a subscriber, it's going to be Tuesday, July 30th for the rest of yous. I just wanted a little update, getting this show back into consistent mode after this new studio, which is pretty much done. We got a couple more days of some stuff going on in here, but we're in it. It's working. We're ready to roll. Just surpassed 300,000 downloads and listeners, which is really cool. Working towards half a mil. We really want to keep this growth trending upwards. And part of that is definitely consistency of the show, the content we're putting out. I know that this week moving forward, that will be a consistent model. We apologize for any inconvenience. We just had to finish this studio just so we're ready for fall. Hope everyone was able to catch our offshoot show that we've launched twice now that will be coming back at the end of this week beyond the show with all your questions answered. We have a ton of great questions we'll get to. And if you haven't yet, it's extremely low cost and we'll give you access to exclusive content. Minimally this show a day early, but then we've already put a number of awesome videos up there. And then once this studio's done, probably Wednesday, we're going to start working on the video content so that you can have video access to our show. So definitely want to check that out. It's on Patreon, patreon.com/Menace2SocietyPodcast. And sign up now. Get your priority subscription for all of our exclusive content and prioritized questions for that show. Still working through the sponsorships and advertising partnerships. Like I told you a number of times, we're going to launch that hopefully end of August. That platform is still open and available. Hoping to have that up and running here in about 2 to 3 weeks. So if you're interested or have an idea of someone who might be, reach out to us via our website at menace2societypodcast.com or email us sponsorship@menace2societypodcast.com. T-shirts are in. Big update. T-shirts are in. Hats are en route. So Patreon all in and VIP subscribers, your shirts will go out today. So look for those hopefully end of this week, maybe depending on shipping time, beginning of next week. But they are getting sent. All right, let's get started. What do you got, a little sports trivia, huh?
Yeah, so for the Patreon subscribers, it is July 29th. So on July 29th, 1986, Donald J. Trump, among other people, won a court case that awarded them $1 in damages from the NFL for violating antitrust laws. What was the league called?
Well, it's not the XFL.
No, that would be Vince McMahon.
86?
86.
86, that's way after the AFL merger.
Yep.
I don't know.
It is the USFL.
And Donald Trump was like owner?
Trump owned the New York team, and he was, they originally were a spring league.
Yeah.
And it was his idea to take them to move them to the fall to compete directly with the NFL. And his main reason was he believed he could win a lawsuit against the NFL for antitrust laws.
Which he did for a dollar.
He won a dollar.
There you go.
There's a good documentary on, I think it's on Netflix, called Small Potatoes.
Yep. But for the rest of yous, it is July 30th. And on July 30th, 2012, this car maker signed a record-breaking 7-year, $559 million sponsorship with EPL club Manchester United. Does anybody know what logo is on their jersey?
I do.
Right now it is?
Yes. It ends this year.
Oh, yeah, I guess 2012, 7 years. Math man.
Chevy.
That's correct. Chevrolet. So all you Man U fans might see a new logo here next year.
Oh, so you don't think Chevrolet will re-sign?
Well, I imagine it's going to be way bigger of a deal than $559 million, because if I'm correct, I'm not a soccer guy, but I believe Man U had like Ronaldo or something that sold the most jerseys ever.
a lot of Chevy logos out there.
Yes, exactly.
All right, that's a little sports trivia. A little soccer in there, a little Donald Trump, and a little NFL, huh?
Yeah, I mixed it all up today.
So he won the lawsuit for a dollar. Look at him.
Yeah, the judge awarded him $1 in damages.
Big win for the Trumpster. Jeez.
And he took that dollar and started his billion-dollar empire.
Yeah, yeah, right.
That's,
right.
That's how he became rich.
You might hear that story somewhere if you Google it. I bet you there's a story about that. All right, well, let's dive into a little college football. I just wanted to kind of go back to what we talked about, I think, about a month ago, kind of a what's going on right now in college football. And so just wanted to go through some things that are occurring across the country, some things that we did when I was in coaching in, you know, at Ohio State and other stops. So usually, you know, spring or fall camp's about to kick off. Two-a-days, everything's about to start. And right before that happens, what we always did, and most universities and most schools do this, is you kind of have to crank it back into coaching mode. You know, you've been recruiting, off, you know, doing off-season player development, and you got to get back into the mode of coaching, right? And so, right, what we always did was we always took 48 hours, 2 days, right before training camp started, and we went away somewhere. The staff did. And for, it was for a number of reasons. One, it was to get you back into coaching mode. You know, we would clinic each other, get up and talk as if you're teaching your room, and you know would just rattle through topic after topic. And the other thing it did is it helped build that staff camaraderie, because the biggest thing I saw in my career was a lack of alignment by your staff is the quickest way to fail. And I saw that several different years where it was just completely malaligned on one side or the other of the ball, or sometimes both. And Urban used to do a kind of a exercise with the coaches all the time. He would say, all right, go through your career and write down how many years you were 10 strong. He always said, or 9 strong. Now it's 10 strong because they added a coach. But how many times were you 9 strong? Like 9 coaches just at the top of their game, had their players playing at the top of their game. And most coaches, I mean, I'm talking about 30-year vets, would come back and say, 0, none. Never did we have 9 strong. And it's just like, how sad is that? Like you're at the top of the pinnacle of the industry. And you can't name 1 year? And Urban obviously had 4 in 30 years. 4. And it's obviously when magical things happen, like 2014, everyone was on their game. Everybody's cooking. So anyways, these staff retreats are really cool. You go out, you know, we went all over the place. When I was at Florida, we went to a million-dollar lake home on this lake in Florida. We went to a hunting lodge, and I got a funny story about that. But then at Ohio State, we went to a number of places. We went to like a cabin out in the mountains on a lake. We went to, and then we ended up going to just Muirfield, the memorial, the country club. But it's really cool. And what it is in college football, your greatest asset as a coach is the guys you work with. And the sad thing is you never really take the time to like learn from each other. Not enough time, really. You know, you see coaches all the time going all over the country for professional development. Maybe they go to a couple NFL mini camps. Maybe they visit with other colleges to study what they're doing. And the most underutilized asset that a coach has is the other coaches he works with, especially offense, defense. Like I used to all the time sit with Kerry Combs and just talk about corner play. And he was such an asset to me in my career. And I know that him listening to what I was teaching receivers was a major asset for him. And it's really a great opportunity. So you go out there and, you know, you do a lot of staff things, go through staff manuals, staff policies, go through the schedule, the calendar, the practice schedules, a lot of administrative stuff. And then after you get through that stuff, then you start clinicking each other. And I'll have 30 minutes to talk about one specific thing that maybe the defensive coaches wanted to hear me talk about, and vice versa. You say, all right, well, Kerry Combs is going to get up and for 30 minutes clinic the whole staff on press corner technique. And it's awesome because you sit there and you learn more football in those 48 hours than you do the rest of the calendar year. It's phenomenal. And then the other thing you do is on that one night you're there, you'll do some type of bonding, you know, and it's not necessarily like a planned event, but I know like we went to up in the cabin in the woods, and after we were done that first day, I know Luke Fickell and Mike Vrabel and myself all went out on this little boat in on this pond or lake and just were fishing till like 2 a.m, drinking beer, hanging out, and just, you know, building that relationship that you need to go into this grind of a season together, right? And one funny story I had about, I think it's hilarious, when I was at Florida, we went to this hunting lodge. And I don't know if I've never even heard of or seen these until I went there, but they're gorgeous. I mean, you're talking about it's like 200 acres of hunting grounds with cabins, and there's just animals everywhere. You can hunt and do all these things. So we went out. So we got done, and we went out. We're going to go hog hunting. We had, I don't know if people are familiar with a guy named Doc Holliday. He's the head coach at Marshall now. He's a country boy from West Virginia. We go out hog hunting, right? We're going to go kill us a hog. Me and I was offensive GA, our defensive GA, Doc and another coach went out to do it. Well, he's like, all right, talking to the defensive GA, he's like, all right, Cronin, you're going to kill this hog, right? I'm going to let you kill the hog, right? So he takes him out to a feeder, right? Which these huge feeders that just fed deer and fed everything. And he's like, all right, I'm going to put you here. He gave him this little tiny pistol, like an old pistol. He's like, you stand right here and aim towards these woods. And we're going to come in the backside and flush the hogs to you. So be ready. He's like, you got to be ready. Make sure your gun's up because it's going to happen fast. You better be ready to shoot them. So we go to do it and we drop them off and we start pulling away. And Doc just starts dying laughing. I'm like, what's so funny, coach? He's like, he ain't got no damn bullets in there. And not only that, he's like, I was like, well, what is it? You just going to chase some pigs to him? He's like, hell no, that's not how you hunt a pig. And we just went out hunting. And this poor GA sitting there with the gun pointed at the woods, nothing coming. And he left him there for like an hour. But it was really fun. Those are the fun times as a coach where you get to do those fun things that you know, you get to bond, you get to grow, you get to learn. It's a great 48 hours. So that's what's probably finishing up right now, coming off this weekend. Usually it'd be today or maybe Friday would be that staff retreat. And then we'd always have a big dinner at the end of the retreat where your wives would come and you'd sit down and you would have, they called it like the Last Supper. It's like, hey, you're about to donate your husbands for 7 months and they're not going to be home at all. So thank you. And we're going to, we appreciate you. And then you eat a fillet, go home, and the next day you wake up and it's ship sailed. You're out of there. Time to go to work. And that was what was really cool about just kind of how everything evolves. I mean, I saw the evolution of our offense and the evolution of just our defenses at different stops. And you saw this evolution and how they would evolve because of the influence of other coaches. I mean, I remember going back to Florida when Urban got hired at Florida. At Utah, it was a spread offense, kind of zone read. You read a defensive end, and then that was their whole offense, right? They didn't know of such a thing as a tight end or fullback, really. And then that had to evolve because getting in the SEC, those defensive ends were athletic enough, twitchy enough to play both the quarterback and running back. So now you needed to involve like a H-back or a tight end or someone to influence them, right? So anyways, you saw this evolution, and it's crazy because I just think when you talk about Urban Meyer and his offense and what made him one of the most transcendent coaches of our lifetime, right? He's got to be top five transcendent coaches, changed the game, right? And you just think about it, and I saw it somewhere on TV or maybe on Twitter, and just how the Pac-12 right now is dying, right? And they need to transform their conference. And the Big 12 is going through it. They have Lincoln Riley, Tom Herman. The Big 12 is trying to come back to relevancy on a national stage, right? And the Big 10 was there. In 2011, the Big 10 was non-existent in the national conversation until Urban Meyer changed the Big 10. And so I was thinking about it, like, what made him so transcendent of a coach? And it was the game at prior to Urban Meyer was very, it was either the 3 yards in a cloud of dust, kind of a pound toughness offensive football game, or it was the basketball on grass, spread offense, dink and dunk, and all this like soft shit, right? Mm-hmm. Urban Meyer was the first, really not, maybe not the first, but he was the one that most relevantly combined the two.
Well, yeah, he would spread them out and then do 3 yards in a cloud of dust.
Yeah, and it wasn't even 3 yards in a cloud of dust, but it was just a power run game, you know? Yeah. And it was because of that Woody Hayes influence, that Earl Bruce influence, that he believed in toughness. He believed in the run game. He believed in offensive line play. But he also was a receiver coach, so he believed in freaky athletes touching the ball in space.
Yeah.
And it was like, you combine the two, and it's what made him different than anyone else in the country, right? Because, and it really got me thinking, like, that's what made him so good. Outside of all the other stuff, and so successful, right, was his ability to keep that toughness element and effort-based program, but do it in spread sets with freaky athletes touching the ball all over the place, right? And I was thinking about all the head coaches in the country. I mean, name me a head coach, and let's what makes them so great or so different, or what is their shtick,
Nick Saban.
Well, Nick Saban, I think, is obvious. He's an NFL-minded coach, right?
That's true.
He's also a defensive head coach, which is important because that's where you get a lot of... And he's had to transform, too. Because they used to be a 3 yards in a cloud of dust, play great defense, and they were successful. But they really took that huge leap to dominant when their offense changed. Because him as a head coach, he wanted to just play to the defense's strength because he's a defensive coach, right? And they had to transform that because... Especially like coming out of like when Lane Kiffin was there is really when it changed. And really when we played him, still it was more of a one receiver offense that featured the running backs, right? And that was when Amari Cooper was there. And
well, yeah, they never really had a good quarterback until recently.
Yeah,
right. They had star quarterback, I guess.
Jalen Hurts was really their first like Heisman candidate quarterback in a long time.
They had like John Parker Wilson.
But so sticking with the Saban family tree, let's call it. Mm-hmm. What about Kirby Smart? I mean, he's definitely one of the top mm-hmm. coaches.
Yeah, another defensive head coach. He's definitely following that Saban model, that recruiting model. They operate very similar to Alabama. That's why there's this two-headed horse race or two-horse race in the SEC. That, I mean, it's not really a two-horse race. You have LSU, you have Florida, you have some other teams, but everyone sees that picture that way because it's basically Saban and mini Saban. You know what I mean? And the other thing he has is that Georgia hasn't done a great job of prior to him being there is he has such a talent-rich state, and he's locking it down. Like, he's making that state his. And it's hard to – it's almost impossible. Not impossible. Lincoln Riley did it last year, but it's really hard to get a top player from the state of Georgia that Kirby Smart wants.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of Lincoln Riley, I mean, he's an up-and-coming coach for sure.
Yeah.
I'd put him in that top tier, I think.
Yeah, for sure. He's an offensive guy now, offensive guru. He's very he gives his players the opportunity to play fast. It's a simple offense. It's a really innovative offense. He's also – his downfall is the defense, though. That's why they haven't done that magical thing that they should have probably by now. Their defense, we talked about it last episode, was 130th in the country in pass defense. And that's the Big 12 conference as a whole, just terrible defense. But also, Lincoln Riley's got to address that. He's got to get that defense right, right? And the other thing they've done is their recruiting is outrageous. It's phenomenal. I mean, they took the number one receiver out of Georgia and got him to Oklahoma. That never happens. I mean, maybe Alabama gets him. Maybe Florida steals him. Even maybe Ohio State has some success in Georgia. I don't know if Oklahoma has recruited Georgia ever. So what he's doing in recruiting is what's going to make the longevity of Lincoln Riley excellent.
Do you think he's kind of still riding the Bob Stoops?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, he's taking it to another level from Bob Stoops. And mm-hmm. also, he was part of the Bob Stoops wave. You know, there's a reason why he was named the coach at Oklahoma, having only really been at Oklahoma. He was never a head coach anywhere. And there's a reason why that happened, because they saw someone that was like super... It fit exactly what they wanted.
I think that's why they draw parallels with him and Ryan Day.
Yeah, for sure. Ryan's got to produce like Lincoln has, but I'll tell you this. Without Lincoln Riley, I doubt Ryan Day's the head coach at Ohio State right now.
Yeah.
Well, kind of similar to how Dabo got his start.
Yeah, I mean, again, very different. We talked about this one episode. Very different because Clemson was failing.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And Oklahoma's thriving, Ohio State's thriving, and they just kind of kept it in the family. But yeah, Dabo's another promoted head coach for sure.
And he's also one of the top two coaches right now.
Oh, absolutely. And then you look at Dabo's success. Why has Dabo Sweeney been so successful? And you point to one thing, and it's the most important aspect of football is, look at his quarterback play the last like 8 years. From the Taj Boyd era to the Deshaun Watson era, now to Trevor Lawrence. I mean, he has always had a superb quarterback. And Taj Boyd might not have been a superb NFL quarterback, but he was an excellent college quarterback. And then you also look at he's had a staple going back to like the Lincoln Riley under Bob Stoops. His staple has been Brent Venables, who's probably the best, if one of the top three, but probably the best defensive coordinator in the country. I'd give Don Brown a run for that. Outside, what they do at Clemson is chaotic. It's really hard to beat. Obviously, we never did it.
Nope.
He's got quarterback play and Brent Venables, right? And then they also have recruited really well at the skill position, and mm-hmm. they've done a number of things. But the one thing Clemson does not do well is that their offensive line play is average. So he's got the quarterback, and you got a DC, you got a defense, you're gonna do really well.
Yeah. So I noticed a theme there. There's a lot of southeastern head coaches in that conversation that we talked about. And nobody on this list that we talked about really from the Pac-12, except for I think there's two in the Pac-12 that you can make an argument for, and that's Kyle Whittingham and Chip Kelly.
What about Mike Leach?
Yeah, I mean, Mike Leach has never been a coach that was going to win big. He's transcends the places he's at. He transforms these schools. Like Washington State was horrific. Texas Tech was horrific. And all of a sudden, he turns them around into a relevant. And he's a different bird now. Yeah, he is a different bird. He's awesome. I mean, he's the best interview in the world. But he does things. Mike Leach has a system, and he just runs it over and over. Mm-hmm. And he'll run plays that are not good plays against a certain defense on paper, but they just do it so often and at such a high level that it's still successful. And so Mike Leach is a good example. Chip Kelly, for sure, it'll be interesting to see how the game is for him, especially at UCLA, because he's been out of college for a while, obviously didn't have success in the NFL. So we'll see how he does. I think he's got a good staff at UCLA, and I think he was one of the most innovative minds in offensive football back at Oregon. Oh, yeah. And even in the NFL, he brought things to the NFL that people said you couldn't do, and he did them, tempo and – you know, QB reads and stuff like that. But Kyle Whittingham, I think, is one of the best in the country. I think Utah has a chance to win the Pac-12 this year.
I think they will.
But he's along that same model, that Saban, that Kirby Smart, where he's just like extremely detail-oriented, toughness-oriented. He's a defensive head coach. He is all about it's that militaristic model of a defensive head coach, where you play Utah, they're going to play really, really hard and really, really tough. And so that's what puts him in that category.
I think we're forgetting one out in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I think I'm going to...
Peterson?
Yeah.
What? No. Herm Edwards.
Oh, no. Enough. Get out of here.
Chris Peterson you could put up there.
Chris Peterson. Sure.
Washington's been the only Pac-12 team to, make the playoff?
Worth a shit.
So you got to talk about him.
Yeah, no, I think he's really good. He was really good at Boise, and he's similar to some of the coaches we talked about. And Washington's a really good job. They do a great job recruiting. Even back when Sarkisian was there, I mean, that's when it really turned. When Sark took over, left USC, went to Washington, and kind of turned Washington into a recruiting powerhouse out on the West Coast. And then they've really parlayed that with some success on the field. It'll be interesting to see how he does in like 2-3 years from now. But he's definitely in that conversation.
So there's a couple big-name coaches and big-name programs that we have not mentioned yet. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on, Dan Mullen at Florida.
Yeah.
Right. He has a chance to get into that level, I think. But why hasn't he, or why hasn't Florida gotten back to that level?
Yeah. I mean, we talked about Florida at length. And I think the biggest thing is Dan Mullen is thrust into this conversation only because he is the coach at Florida. He would not be in this conversation based off his successes on the field, based on his resume, but he gets thrust into this group because he got the job at Florida. And why did he get the job at Florida? Because Florida wasn't an attractive job. It wasn't. I mean, the stadium's not selling out anymore. They really have fallen off. The recruiting has been down to some extent, especially from the Urban Meyer era. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, all right, so why did he get the job? He got the job because Scott Frost didn't want the job. Think about that. This was a job that was top five in the country in 2005, when Urban turned down Notre Dame to go to Florida.
Well, yeah, you're in talent-rich Florida. It's recruiting. It's got to be easy, right?
He didn't have the resume to get the Florida job that Urban Meyer got in 2005. Dan Mullen had the resume to get the Florida job in 2018 or whatever it was. That's why he got that job. Now, I think Dan, you could talk about Dan all day long. He's a very good offensive coach, very innovative, very smart. I don't think he has the swagger to be a great head coach or to be a great recruiting head coach, but he's a really good football coach. So obviously you don't become the head coach of Florida being a shitty coach, but I don't think he's relevant to that conversation. It's a lot like Jim Harbaugh. He's had a lot of success at a lot of stops. He's been a really, really good head coach at times, but somebody sent me this stat. I think it was the guys from the Scarlet and Great podcast sent me a stat that in the last four games of the season at Michigan, Jim Harbaugh is 7-9. If you combine all the last four games, because his program falls apart. And that's also when they start playing better teams, right? Yeah. They play Ohio State. He's obviously 0-4 against them. Mm-hmm. And then they play a bowl game and so his program just falls apart at the end. 7-9 in the last four games of the season. Think about that. It's out of 16 games, 7 wins. So that's what I think. He's not really in that conversation. I mean, he's had successes at Stanford, successes in the NFL, but he hasn't done it at Michigan, and that's what we're talking about, right?
He wins 10 games.
He wins 10 games. That's great. Talk about a guy that won 10 games a lot, but got fired. Was Mark Richt.
Yep, that's what I was just going with. I mean, he was 10 games every year at Georgia, but that wasn't good enough for Georgia anymore.
No, and look at why. What happened? Georgia's in the playoffs now every year.
They got Kirby Smart.
Well, yeah, because Mark Richt runs a clean program centered around the betterment of young men. If that's what you value, he's up in that top tier. Mm-hmm. He's a Christian, faith-based man that runs a great program and cares about the betterment of young men. The problem is people don't care about that. They should, right? But they don't. They care about one thing. Is he in the playoffs or is he not in the playoffs? Did he win the SEC? That's all they care about. Mm-hmm. If you value wins, championships, hardware, relevancy, then it doesn't matter. As good of a betterment of young men as you are, you're out.
That was tough, too, though, because he had Urban Meyer to deal with every single year.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm with you. It's the nature of the game, right? Yeah. Look at guys like, I mean, other jobs that should be up there, like Florida State should be up there, but Willie Taggart, like, stop it. You can't even recruit at Florida State. That hire was a mistake. And I know there's talk that they might get this kid, Miami, Florida State, Ohio State battle, Jalen Knighton. And Florida State has always been an attractive school to that South Florida area. But hopefully they can land somebody of relevancy, or else you're just going to look at this and say, what is going on in Tallahassee?
All right. Well, we've been teasing this topic, and I really wanted to talk about it today. I wanted to talk about Brett McMurphy and what happened with him and all of that kind of stuff.
Right. So we haven't really talked about it because it's irrelevant now to my life, but, right. It's definitely, I guess, a story worth telling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty relevant in the history of my life, of college football, of Urban Meyer's career. And, if you look at, I guess, you know, what we should call it instead of we used to do the segment Twitter Tough Guy. This should be called Facebook Tough Guy. That's what Brett McMurphy is. He's a Facebook Tough Guy. Oh, how careers have changed, right? He went from being an ESPN insider, all access guru of nothing, and ESPN laid him off, obviously, because he's such a clown, and he found himself in complete irrelevancy. He was living in the land of irrelevant, and the one thing ESPN did is they kept him under contract, though, probably because they think he's such a douchebag. They're like, no, we'll keep you under contract so you can't go anywhere and talk about sports at all. And that's how much they valued him. And really, you know, if you build good relationships, that's how employers treat you when they lay you off. They say, yeah, not only are we going to lay you off, but we're not going to help you get another job, or we hope your life sucks the rest of your life. But so he got laid off April 2017 from ESPN when they did all those massive layoffs, right? And he was under contract, and so in his mind, I think he needed to come back in a big way. Like, he needed to find his way back into relevancy.
Yeah, and he had no real outlet to do it.
No, and so
that was the only way. It was Facebook.
It was Facebook, and then he, I think, helped launch Stadium.com, which I don't know what that is still. No one had ever heard of it, and I still haven't heard of it other than this.
No, the only things they've ever reported on are you.
Yeah, Zach Smith Stadium. It's like, do I have naming rights to the stadium? But so he utilized a private and personal mess, which was a mess, to launch his resurgence into relevancy. And he was like a preschool kid that was mad. The older kids took his ball, and so he ran and told the teacher. You know what I mean? The funniest thing is, you talk about, I mean, just integrity. Not only as a human, not only as a professional, but as a reporter, you should have some integrity as a reporter. And he would go, and I guess I'm going to use air quotes, he would write an article on Facebook. As that article got picked apart piece by piece, he would just edit the post.
Yeah.
Over and over, his entire story changed, but it was never like a redaction or a correction post. It was always just, oh yeah, that didn't happen, let me just delete that out. And it was like, well, what was your story? If once you put a story out, the story is out. You can't just change it a week later. And first it was I was arrested for domestic violence. Then it was, I was charged for domestic violence. Then at one point, I think he wrote that I killed 17 people at a gas station. And then later that was edited to say that I only saw 17 people at a gas station. It's like, because you already got the clicks, man. I get it. I get how it works. I'm proud of you, bro. But what he didn't do that I think everyone in sports media should do is he never tried to vet the story. And by that I mean you try to get both sides, then you as a reporter evaluate it, what's real, and then you write an article. What you believe with integrity is the story. And he never tried to do that once. He never reached out to me. He never reached out to anyone on my side of anything. He simply was clickbaiting, trying to bring Urban Meyer down, trying to be a guy that has all this insider info because Tom Herman passed him off to Courtney Smith, all this other stuff. And it was completely about trying to become relevant again. And he only talked to me, I'll say, 3 months after all of it went. I mean, I'd already got fired. Urban's already suspended. It was like, I think, September when he finally called me. And it was only, I think, because I threw a fit on social media about how he was such a coward, he wouldn't even call me. Like, what a man. How about you grow a pair of balls, Brett? Give me a call. My line's open. He had my number. He put out all kinds of documents and forgot to scratch them out, which I appreciated. Thanks for that.
Didn't he call you from a blocked number, though?
Yeah, of course he did. And I have his number. I might put it on the air. I have his real cell phone number. I'm going to put Brett McMurphy's cell phone number on air at some point. Give him a call. Let him know how he's doing. How he's doing. And he's still riding that wave. He's still riding it. He's talking about, oh, my family got threatened. You shut your ass up, Brett. You brought it, whatever happened, you brought on yourself for being such a shitty reporter. And no one's family should be threatened ever. But don't cry about it now.
Well, it's not like he's the only one.
Oh, yeah, what are we talking about?
Threats.
He should have come live my life for a couple months.
Right?
Like, Jesus. Get out of here. You're gonna whine and cry about it now when you talk to classes. Shut your soft ass up.
I haven't heard anything about him since.
No.
And the thing that I find very interesting is that I looked into him a little bit because I didn't know who he was when he broke the story. The thing is, this is the second time that he's broken a story with like minimal sources or no sources outside of it to try to get a head coach fired, essentially.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
He did it down in South Florida. He reported that some walk-on, the head coach at halftime of a game, grabbed some random walk-on.
Yeah, Jim Levitt.
And put him up against the locker, grabbed him by the throat, and then hit him in the face twice. And, I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. It could be.
Maybe.
But it was reported, and he would not let it go until they finally fired him.
But don't you think, like, a story like that would come out somehow, other than Brett McMurphy with no sources?
Yeah.
Exactly.
The problem is he'll take the slightest sliver of a story and make it into a huge story. He did it afterwards. Like, he had already destroyed me, and so obviously I was just collateral damage. He didn't care about me, know me, anything. He was just trying to bring down Urban Meyer so he could say he brought down Urban Meyer so he could like pound his chest and look in the mirror at night with his wife beater t-shirt and say, "Ah, I brought down Urban Meyer. Like, I'm the man." And so he didn't get it done.
He only got a 3-game suspension, so then he wanted another story.
Yeah, he wanted a story.
To keep going.
So he exploited a kid's personal family, a great kid, a great mom. He completely exploited them because he didn't get the relevancy he wanted. And the initial one, at least there was a mess that he turned into something that it wasn't. But at least there was a mess, a bad situation, right? There was a personal situation that was not what he ended up reporting. But at least there was something he could try to spin. This second story he did was based on absolutely nothing. He took a kid and hurt this kid, hurt his family. And he didn't hurt me. I was already fired. I don't care. But he had to try to say Urban Meyer was a bad guy in another way. So he protected a domestic abuser. That's one hot button way to tear down Urban Meyer. The other way is he covered up a racist.
Oh yeah, you called Trayvon Grimes the N-word, right? Oh, that's what he reported.
Certainly I did.
Yeah, your room full of young black African Americans just let you do that.
Yeah, and never mind the fact that. That's the last thing in the world I would ever do. It was laughable, but it wasn't even, I mean, that was huge. It was like, whoa, timeout. You can call me a lot of things. You'll never call me a racist. It's just never going to happen. I have, I don't know, countless relationships with people of different races that are very genuine and real. And I don't believe in racism. I think it's a huge problem in the country. And you'll never find me on that side of that debate or issue. And he released an article claiming Trayvon Grimes left Ohio State because I use a racial slur. And his only source that claimed this was a kid's dad that hadn't talked to him in like 5 years. Or maybe like 3 or 4 years. Still doesn't talk to him to this day. Does not speak to him. That was his source. And then he kept going. He said, I told several people that Trayvon Grimes wasn't coachable. Like, what? Wasn't coachable. He's a great kid. He was coachable. He was a typical freshman that didn't know how to take hard coaching, take appropriate and constructive hard coaching. But that's pretty much every freshman ever.
Yeah.
And that's certainly not why he left. And I'm not going to dive into why he left, but it was a personal issue that, that had to do with a medical condition. I mean, it was something that he needed to be closer to home. That's it. And Brett McMurphy's funny because he communicated with my lawyer one time. And the only reason he communicated with him was to flirt with the lines of blackmail. Because he had all these personal documents and personal things were given to him from my ex-wife. And he wanted to, he didn't blackmail me. Obviously, you're not going to blackmail a lawyer. That's a quick way to get sued. And he knew he was operating under this umbrella that's called a public figure. You can say and do anything. We talked about on the show early in the show's infancy. You can say anything in the world about a person that can be labeled a public figure and no, they can't do anything about it. Even if you could completely fabricate it, make it up, it doesn't matter. There's nothing that can be done legally. Nothing. I tried. And it was like, he had that stick in his hand. He said, you can't touch me. I'm saying whatever I want. But he did. He took all my personal documents, everything that he got from my ex-wife, and he send one or two to my lawyer. Like, man, it would be really bad if this got out.
It would suck if this came out. Huh?
And first of all, I was like, at this point, I don't care. Put whatever you want. Like, I've already lost my career. It's already go ahead, man. Have at it. If you really care about me that much. But he also, if you read on social media, he was shopping all that stuff around to other media outlets, talking about it for $10,000. I'll give you this stuff on Zach Smith. And he was shopping it around. And it's just, you talk about a complete lack of integrity in a human being, let alone a reporter. It's that guy. So you probably won't hear from him until something he fabricates or exaggerates another story to try to become relevant again. But that's the politics of college football and sports media, and that's the sad state of sports media, is they have got people like that are just bad people.
Do you think he has a vendetta against Ohio State particularly?
I think he has maybe Urban. Yeah, he definitely has a vendetta against Urban. I don't know the timeline, if he was down at the Tampa Tribune when Urban was at Florida. I know Florida. He lives in St. Pete.
Yeah, he was there until like 2009, I think. So he was definitely down there.
He probably was one of those reporters that just was going off on Urban Meyer and his program and hated Urban Meyer. And anyone that has success is going to have people like that. And so I don't know. I don't think it was. I certainly don't think it was against Ohio State. I can't imagine it was against me. I didn't even know who the human being was until he started this shit.
So you're saying USC is fair game for him?
Yeah, right. But that's the politics, and college football is so political. Even stuff like that, and I was thinking about other political situations, not necessarily with the media, but there was one instance that kind of directly affected my career. Was what happened with West Virginia back in 2010-ish. They I don't know if you remember, but so West Virginia has Bill Stewart as the interim head coach, and they had a decent year. They're going to go to the, I believe it was the Fiesta Bowl and play Oklahoma, right? Mm-hmm. And so the AD at the time at West Virginia, I think it was Oliver Luck maybe, he's going to hire Doc Holliday as the next head coach. Doc Holliday was a long time assistant at West Virginia, was at Florida with Urban. Doc Holliday leaves his position at Florida to take the West Virginia job, goes to Morgantown, West Virginia, is ready to be announced as the head coach of West Virginia. And then the night before the press conference, West Virginia beats Oklahoma in the Fiesta Bowl.
I remember that.
Yep. And the governor, I think it might have been Munchin or whoever the governor was, in the locker room after the game, announces that Bill Stewart will become the permanent head coach. Like, completely circumvents the AD.
That's so weird.
And Doc Holliday, I remember hearing the story, Doc Holliday heard about it on ESPN from the hotel room in Morgantown as he's about to be announced as the head coach.
Could you imagine John Kasich doing that at Ohio State? Kasich. Like, what?
Yep, but Luke Fickell is the head coach. Anyways, John Kasich said it.
But that's insane that a governor would do that.
Well, you look at what the kind of timeline of what happened. So then what do you do? here this guy is, that he's a successful coach. He's a longtime West Virginia guy. He comes to be your head coach, left his job. Now you hire another guy as a head coach. Now this guy has no job. Doc Holliday, no job. Yep. What are you going to do? So the AD tried to make it right and named Doc as like the associate head coach and paid him like almost as much as the head coach. And it just created a cultural mess because there was two head coaches, essentially, one that was going to get hired that didn't, and one that wasn't going to that now was the head coach. And fortunately, Doc got the Marshall job, I think, a year or two later. And that's so I guess this would have been 2008-ish, 2009 maybe, when this happened at West Virginia, because then he took the Marshall job and he gave me my first job. And but it's just it's crazy how the inner workings of college football are so political, so wild and bizarre, right?
Well, I feel like a lot of people get like real butthurt, or like they get an idea in their head and they want to like hurt somebody back, or they get kind of petty about stuff.
Yeah, and for sure. And also, I think it's just the politics of power. Like the governor is making a call for the state university, circumventing, undermining the AD. It's just so many like. It's almost like House of Cards of football, right? Like, whoa, you killed who? And they killed what? Like, whoa, season 4, episode 7 is crazy. But it's like, it's just bizarre. And there, I remember, I mean, there's so many stories like that. Just how head coaches become head coaches, how agents work in all of that. And how it used to be, I know back when Urban was the receiver coach at Notre Dame, Bowling Green, the head coaching job came open. Their biggest booster is a guy named Bob Sebo, who played for Earl Bruce in high school. So he called Earl Bruce and said, hey, we're letting our head coach go. Who do you got for me?
Who do you want me to hire?
And Earl Bruce said, you have to hire Urban Meyer from Notre Dame. And so they hired Urban Meyer from Notre Dame. And it worked out well for Bowling Green.
Yeah.
That's how it used to work. It's not how it works anymore. Now there's search committees, hiring firms, politics, agencies, agents getting involved with other agents. And now it's become like AAU basketball for coaches. When it used to be like, no, let's just get a couple recommendations from some successful coaches that so we can find another successful coach. Now it's like, we're going to call this accountant in Colorado and he's going to tell us who the best coach is. Like, what? What does that guy know about coaching?
He's going to put all their names into a spreadsheet and crunch some numbers
and pop out
the best one.
Right. And it's
Sashi Brown for coaches.
It's unbelievable. And it's the state of the industry, really. Now we rely on search firms and law firms and lawyers and accountants and people like that to tell us who's the best head coach for Miami of Ohio. Like, what? How did who? But I mean, it's the way the industry is now, and it's just it's so political, and it really makes grown men become so petty. And you see it in recruiting all the time. I mean, I saw so many things. I remember Tom Herman tried to turn Urban Meyer in for an illegal bump one time, and this is when he first got to Texas. We went to a camp down in Texas, and how it works in camps are these kids have to come and register, and they have to pay to be at the camp. And if they pay to be at the camp, now they're campers. Coaches can talk to them. But if they don't pay to be at the camp, then you can't talk to them. It's a no contact period, right? So we went down to a camp in Texas, and there was a couple of receivers. One of them is actually at Texas now that came over to the camp so that they could hang out with the Texas coaches, Ohio State coach, you know, a bunch of schools. Mm-hmm. Well, somehow the camp failed, and they hadn't paid, but they were in the camp. But, you know, who knows that? No one. Well, so Urban was talking to one of the receivers. I was talking to him. And then Tom Herman, I guess, went over and, like, did his research through the camp staff that this kid didn't pay to be in the camp yet. And he started threatening to turn Urban in. And it's like, whoa, timeout. This is just – we thought he was a part of the camp. He ended up going and paying, coming back. Now we can talk to him. But it just turns a grown man into a petty little schoolgirl.
You got
to
check the receipts before you talk.
It's unbelievable. And, I mean –
do they have a stamp on their hand?
Yeah,
check
it. They get a stamp?
Right.
The bracelet.
Even then, who knows if the 16-year-old working the gate didn't just stamp him because it's a big-time recruit that they know or whatever. And I saw it. I mean, it happened. Ed Warner turned in Brian White, a guy that I was really close with when he was at Florida. He turned in Brian White for talking to Curtis Samuel in a high school. Like, granted, you're not supposed to do that. It's a no contact. You're not supposed to talk to him at all. But every coach in America talks to him for a minute, just says hi, tries to get a face-to-face interaction. You don't excessively step over the boundaries, but you talk to him. You say hi. You say, how you doing? How's school? How's your mom? You know, how's class is going, whatever. You have maybe a 1 minute conversation and then you say, all right, well, you know, I'm not allowed to talk to you. So I just wanted to let you know I came by and just let you know we'd love to have you on campus or whatever. Yeah. You just, it's a quick interaction. And like Ed Warner turned in Brian White just because there was such a pressure on him to help sign Curtis Samuel. And thank God we sent Stan Drayton in to get the job done because that would have never happened. But
I think it'd be more awkward if he just avoids him at all costs.
Well, that's why
you know the guy.
I mean, it's like anything else, right? it's just like how coaches get paid so much. Like, well, if the other school's paying a coach $1 million, we better pay a coach $1 million. Well, if the other school's talking to him for 1 minute, I better not blow him off. That kid's not coming here. But it's the hypocrisy that is the NCAA, right? They let coaches get away with some things they can't get away with. And it's like you as a coach have to figure out what is actually penalized. Not what is illegal. What is penalized? Because that's what I need to not do.
Right.
But it can college football, the pressure cooker that is college football, can make grown men do things that they would not normally do. I remember we were at Florida and we had this guy who was like in charge of recruiting, older guy, not a tough guy, was really, recruiting was going decent, but we had like a bad recruiting visit weekend or something. So he was in the pressure cooker with Urban Meyer and he snapped, he broke. I mean, he broke and he ended up driving home after work, getting a gun, and he was driving to Urban's to shoot him. one of our defensive coaches found out about it and went and like intervened halfway there, stopped him, talked him off the ledge. But like you talk about the landscape of college football being different. But think of it, obviously can't be that sane, but this is a somewhat sane human being that is like, screw it. I can't do it anymore. Give me a gun. Let me go get my gun. I'll end this problem.
We didn't land that running back. I'm shooting that guy.
Right. But that is college football for you, and that is recruiting. I mean, it is a wild, wild west out there. All right, that's about all the time we got today. I appreciate you tuning in. I wanted to let you know this. The Menace to Society podcast.com storefront will be launching this week. So we will have our Menace to Society apparel. We have a couple hats, a t-shirt on there. If you're interested in supporting and kind of getting swagged out, we got that coming. We also have some pre-order stuff going to be available in our Zone 6 line and also our Trash Talk line, some really funny shirts. And a great Brett McMurphy shirt. So make sure you subscribe and download now on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And make sure you rank us. 5 stars are appreciated, obviously. No, wouldn't really like 1 stars. But 5 stars and leave feedback. Leave comments. We read it all. Also, you can always give us feedback on our website, menacetosocietypodcast.com. And I mentioned it before, advertising and sponsorships. We're going to do a live show. We got some big things coming, video show. We're also going to split this off into a couple different shows to really attack different genres to keep it specific for the listeners. And so if you want to be a part of that, you want to kind of partner up on that, the platform is, we're working on it. So we'd love to hear from you. It's sponsorship@menacetosocietypodcast.com. Hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you liked it. Hope it was entertaining, valuable, educational. And if you didn't like it, as we say, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
Menace to society.